Good morning, and welcome to The People's Business, a production of the Fiscal Policy Institute and WRPI's Public Affairs Committee. And we're part of WRPI's regular Thursday morning feature, Capital District Progressive Radio. I'm Frank Morrow, Executive Director Emeritus of the Fiscal Policy Institute. That means I used to be the director of the Fiscal Policy Institute, but now I help out part-time. And I'm pleased to be joined in the studio by Brian McDonald, AFSCME New York's Legislative and Political Director, and Ron Deutsch, Executive Director of New Yorkers for Fiscal Fairness. We're going to try our best to cast a little sunshine on the ways in which government is doing and not doing the people's business. Although New York State government and politics is in its regular annual rhythm, starts each year, except for years when a new governor is elected, but in all other years when there's not an inauguration of a new governor, the governor starts off the legislative session for the year by giving what's called the State of the State address on the opening day of the legislative session. Later in today's program, we'll be speaking with State Senator Dianne Savino about her thoughts about the 2013-14 State of the State message that Governor Cuomo gave yesterday. And we'll also talk to her about her outlook generally for the 2014 session of the state legislature. But before we hear from Senator Savino, we're pleased to be joined on the telephone by Jimmy Vielkind, Capital New York's Albany Bureau Chief. Jimmy, thank you very much for joining us this morning.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
Hey, Jimmy, welcome to the show. This is Ron Deutsch, and I also wanted to welcome you here to WRPI 91.5 FM in Troy.
It's a pleasure. My father is an RPI alum, and more importantly, he's a WRPI alum. So
wow.
Happy to be here.
Well, we're certainly glad to have you, and you know, obviously we want to talk to you about many of the happenings over at the Capitol yesterday with the governor's State of the State speech and your thoughts on the coming legislative session, but you know, you're one of the more astute observers, I think, in the press corps, and certainly someone who digs in into a lot of investigative journalism around many of the things that are happening at the Capitol. But you are now with Capitol New York, which is playing a big part in what's going on at the Capitol and reporting on what's going on at the Capitol. Why don't you tell us a little bit about Capitol New York and the role they're playing?
Well, sure. Capitol New York is a digital venture mostly, and the website is capitalnewyork.com. You got to spell out New York, and it's capital with an A-L. And it is a site that's a few years old and was founded by some old colleagues of mine from the New York Observer, but was recently bought by the parent company of Politico, which is, of course, the Washington, D.C.-based digital politics outlet. So we're really excited that this year we have the biggest bureau at the Capitol, full five reporters, and we've been looking at the gears of the state government as well as the politics. So I encourage people to check us out if they have a moment. Again, it's capitalnewyork.com, and it's capital with an A-L.
Hi, Jimmy. This is Brian McDonald. I'd like to wish you a happy new year and welcome to our show.
Thanks, Brian.
You know, as Ron mentioned, you've been covering the Capitol for a long time, first at the Times Union and now at Capitol New York. It's an election year, and if you didn't know that, you would have figured it out after listening to the governor's speech yesterday in his State of the State address. So I'm going to ask you, as someone who's pretty familiar with the inner workings of the state capitol, we have three conferences in the state senate, and maybe four now. I'm not sure exactly what Malcolm Smith is doing, but we've got the independent Democrats, we've got the Republican conference, we've got the Democratic conference. How do you think this is all going to play out this year in the upper chamber?
It's going to be very tricky to see. There are some items that Cuomo is hoping to push that are, not being well received on the right, and other things that he's pushing that are not going to be well received on the left. I think that when you look at Cuomo's big priorities, there's going to be his top priority seems to be this package of tax cuts that he unveiled earlier this week, which includes several things, including a property tax freeze, some sort of a circuit breaker in the out years, but also, and I think very significantly, cuts in the corporate franchise rate, a property tax rebate for businesses, and changes to the estate tax, which I know that many people on the left, including I think the three people who are hosting this radio show, have some problems with.
What makes you think?
So the question is going to be, okay, if Cuomo wants to do that, he'll have allies in the Republican conference of the state Senate, which we saw in the last year was more of the dominant force in that ruling coalition. It was able to bring bills to the floor, and it essentially is running things as it has for many, many years. But on the other side of that, you have the Democrats who dominate the Assembly, and you have that four-member IDC, or Independent Democratic Conference. And one of the top priorities they've expressed is allowing New York City to raise taxes on its wealthy residents to fund universal pre-kindergarten services. So I think that that kind of there might be some ripeness for a compromise, balancing those two forces off of each other. Otherwise, you know, Governor Cuomo didn't do too much in his speech that was particularly offensive or noteworthy. I thought it was something of a play it safe speech for an election year, Brian, as you noted. And so, to get back to your question about the state Senate, it's going to be difficult to predict. Last year, as I said, we saw that whenever the IDC said it wanted a bill to come to the floor, and there are a couple that immediately come to mind. One was allowing for the public financing or the partial public financing of electoral campaigns, and another one related to abortion and changes to the abortion laws. In both these instances, the IDC was unable to get the bill to the floor. And they received a lot of flack from, again, a lot of progressive groups, a lot of unions that were supporting these things for not being able to bring the bill to the floor, despite the fact that they said that their Senate alliance would allow these kinds of consideration of these kinds of measures. So I don't know if that dynamic is going to change. My suspicion is it won't. My suspicion is that the key factor in terms of getting these measures to the Senate floor, even when it's over the objection of Republicans there, is going to be the support or the non-support of the governor. So we're going to have to see how much political capital he's going to spend and how he's going to spend it. And I think that's going to be one of the big variables in how the state Senate functions this year.
So, Jimmy, later on in this program, we're going to have Senator Dianne Savino, who's a member of the IDC, to discuss some of these issues. But I have to say, as I walked the halls yesterday, I did notice that the new mayor of New York City, Bill de Blasio, was in town. And obviously, that's always covered. The new mayor of New York City is always covered like a rock star in the Capitol. But he made a very notable appearance at the IDC social event, which happened after the governor's speech. So the question is, will the IDC be more aggressive this year? And I think you're correct that the Republican half of that coalition was the dominant partner. But I do think that the few members of the IDC feel like they're under a lot more pressure, maybe to deliver part of their
progressive
agenda.
And progressive.
So perhaps, if you're reading the tea leaves, right, and you see that Bill de Blasio showed up to their event and Jeff Klein is trying to be as close as possible to the mayor, it's going to be fascinating to see how this all unfolds this year.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with that, Brian. We've already seen it. You know, Klein and the IDC unveiled something called an Affordable New York Plan. They sort of laid out their own agenda last month and last year. And as we've seen a few other things happen, including the departure of Senator Chuck Fuscillo, that means the Republicans are one vote down. The Democrats are a vote down with the departure of Eric Adams, who was elected borough president. I think just mathematically, the IDC's hand is strengthened a little bit. They have some time under their belts, and I do think you'll see them be more aggressive. I think that it's too early to say how exactly it's going to play out. And I'd be curious to hear what Senator Savino has to say and what her predictions are. But I definitely think that's correct. I definitely think you will see a more unabashedly progressive and aggressive IDC, if for no other reason that they know that they are threatened from their political left. And I think they want to buttress themselves in any way they can.
Yeah, I think the dynamic, especially with de Blasio, is interesting, you know, certainly between de Blasio and Cuomo. But if you look at, like, the national Democrats, President Obama, Biden, they're all talking about things like income inequality and, hiking the minimum wage, all that stuff. And you've also got de Blasio talking about that now. So how do you think that dynamic's going to play out in Albany? I mean, we have a governor who, you know, some days he's a progressive, some days he's a conservative. He's a progressive conservative, if that's even possible. But he seems to make that work sometimes. And I'm just wondering, how do you think they have a little honeymoon period now. They're buddy-buddy, and we worked together in the past. But that is not going to last long. I mean, this is going to be, it seems like a knockdown drag-out during this session for de Blasio to get what he wants from the governor and legislature.
Well, we'll see. Both De Blasio and Cuomo have so far had nothing but good things to say about each other. Mm-hmm. They emphasize the fact that they've known each other for a long time. Right, so far. Mm-hmm. It's interesting. I don't know to what extent Cuomo will be sort of swayed by the national winds as they see them blowing. I'm thinking back, I think probably the best example is late in 2011, when the Occupy movement was roaring at its strongest and when there was a lot of pressure on Cuomo to renew an expiring surcharge, the so-called millionaire's tax, that was first enacted in 2009. And essentially, Cuomo renewed most of it in small part while trimming it slightly both in the middle and on the top rates. So it allowed Cuomo to say that he was cutting taxes because he technically was cutting taxes. But by renewing most of that surcharge, he also was able to provide more revenue and funding that people on his left were really pushing him for. So I think he's no dummy. He sees that, but he also isn't going to eagerly embrace it. He's going to be a reluctant partner, if anything. And I think he's going to want to look for a way that it can be cast where he doesn't have to be pinned with raising taxes. I think that he wants to, as you said, or as Larry Levy from Hofstra told me in an article published today, he's a parsimonious progressive. He doesn't want to be seen as having that straight economic model of raising money, having the government raise a lot of money and spending it and investing it. I think that that is not the core of his philosophy, and he's decided that he doesn't think that is the best politics right now, especially as he looks to move perhaps from New York to a national stage.
It's very clear that this is a guy who's capable of making the pivot, right? So the example that you give of 2011, for a year he had spoken about how we tax enough in New York, we don't need to raise any taxes. And then, he goes ahead and does, make the changes to have a progressive tax system. And then yesterday in his State of the State address, while he's talking about how cutting taxes is a top priority, he points to the merits of a progressive tax system and complained that the old system was a flat tax and how it's much more fair. So it's interesting how this is a governor who tries to stake out positions on both sides and seems to have been able to get away with that up till this point.
And he not only mentioned the change in the tax code, but he strongly defended it, and he included a graphic in his PowerPoint presentation showing the difference between the pre-December, the pre 2009 system, the pre David Patterson progressive tax change system, and what it is now. So it's not quite as progressive at the top as it used to be, but Cuomo takes great pride in these small rate reductions in the middle, and he talks about it as a progressive rate structure. This is The People's Business on WRPI Troy, and we're speaking with Jimmy Vielkind, who's the Capital Bureau Chief, the Albany, New York State Capital Bureau Chief for Capital New York, an online news entity service that is covering Albany like a blanket this year. Jimmy mentioned they have a 5-person bureau, which is quite impressive given the diminution of the coverage of some of the traditional media outlets over the years. Jimmy, to turn to something substantive in the speech, the governor said that the state is going to take over the revitalization and rebuilding of Kennedy and LaGuardia airports from the Port Authority. Traditionally, the Port Authority was seen as a very well-run agency, but that seems to have changed. What's going on, and do you have any idea what's behind this plan and how it's going to work? Is the Port Authority going to pay for the refurbishment and this New York State just manage it, or is it something more significant?
Well, as of yet, we haven't heard many details, and I don't know if you've heard more details, Frank.
No, I haven't.
Beyond what was said in the speech, I mean, you're correct in that the Port Authority was actually in many ways kind of one of the first real hefty public authorities. And when it was founded in the early 20th century, I think either the late 20s or the 30s, it really was innovative and made the point of, look, we've got this giant harbor. Half of it is in one state, half of it is in the other. We should manage it correctly. And over time, throughout the 20th century, it expanded to run the airports. It took over a bi-state commuter rail called the PATH. It, of course, built the World Trade Center, which was controversial at the time when it did it. But this was the agency, like I said, sort of the archetypal public authority. And it was run originally by a guy named Austin Tobin, who is sort of the archetypal bureaucrat and has been described by some as a Robert Moses without, only better and without a lot of the lightning rod effects that Robert Moses himself had. I think what we're seeing has some elements of Governor Cuomo being frustrated, because if you have flown through Kennedy or LaGuardia airports, you know that they're kind of dumpy. I just went through, my wife and I went on a trip to Ireland, and we were just so struck by, you get off of the plane in Dublin. And Dublin and Ireland, these are not crazily prosperous places, but it's not a city on the size or scale of New York in this world. But the airport was clean, it was efficient, it was new, everything was fine. And then you get off the plane at JFK, and there's not a clean bathroom within a 1 mile square radius. So I think that the governor is recognizing this problem, and he wants to push to do something. We saw him do something similar, Frank, remember, with the Peace Bridge Authority. And the Peace Bridge, of course, is a span that connects Buffalo to Canada. And the governor was just upset at the lack of progress on this authority, upset at the lack of progress at upgrades on the checkpoints that were causing traffic delays. So he agitated, and he was able to win some change. We're also seeing, vis-a-vis the Port Authority right now, a kind of a burgeoning scandal involving Governor Christie, the governor of New Jersey. So certainly if Andrew Cuomo wants to make a political argument for more power and more authority over New York's airports from the Port Authority, he's got an ideal climate in which to do so.
Right. And if the governor wasn't happy enough about his State of the State speech, I think the news about Chris Christie probably just put him over the top. but let me talk to you, change gears a little bit here, talk to you about the governor and his relationship with the media. I kind of find this fascinating. I mean, here's a governor who is absolutely interested in controlling any message that comes out of the second floor, making sure that people aren't talking to the press. And if they are, they've got their talking points, surrounds himself at press conferences with people who are only absolutely in 100% agreement with his positions. And he seems to be reluctant to grant interviews, answer lots of questions. I mean, how do you see the relationship between the media and this governor, maybe relative to other governors?
Well, I think Andrew Cuomo has been very sophisticated, as you say, in message control. And he's certainly very disciplined and sort of demands discipline from those around him. But I think that's true of any major political figure, Democrat, Republican, up, down, left, right. You see a lot of criticisms of Barack Obama and his dealings with the press as well. So, I think that the governor and his team, they certainly came into office knowing a lot. You know, of course, we have to keep in mind Andrew Cuomo has been around the Capitol since the 1980s when his father was governor. So I think that he has worked to manage the message. I think he has, in some instances, avoided the legislative press, the kind of the Capitol press corps, which I say this, and I don't think in a boastful way, is more likely to ask him a tougher substantive question about policy than when he goes to an event in another part of the state, and maybe it's a reporter who doesn't really follow these issues with quite the same regularity. But I have written about how Governor Cuomo controls his message and the tactics that he has used, and I'll let those reports speak for themselves. But certainly no doubt, as you point out, Ron, that he is very keen on managing his message.
So, Jimmy, any after reviewing the State of the State, did you see any big surprises, anything jump out at you that you thought was not going to be in there that was in there, or something you thought would be in there that wasn't?
You know, I was actually I was surprised by the Raise the Age. This is a campaign that people have started, in which you take the age of adult criminal responsibility, the age at which a teenager is charged as an adult, and they want to raise it from 15 to, I believe, 18 years old. And Governor Cuomo embraced that, I think, for the first time. I didn't see it coming. I don't think others saw it coming. And that's something that fits into this whole idea of parsimonious progressive, where he's doing something that is valid and valuable to to people on his left, but doesn't really go to that whole economic progressivity that people like Bill de Blasio espouse. So that one did surprise me. And also this idea of a bond act for school funding, which, you know, according to the State of the State book, is going to be focused on technology, but will also include facilities upgrades for pre-K. So I'm going to be very curious to watch the details of that and how that gets rolled out.
One aspect of the bond issue that's interesting is beginning last year, the environmental community, including the at least the chair of the Assembly Environmental Protection Committee, Bob Sweeney, and maybe the Senate chair, but the environmental advocacy community was gearing up for an environmental bond act. Except for the fact that facilities will clearly be needed to go from half day pre-K in a part of the state school system to a full day pre-K in the entire school system, that does seem a logical reason for needing capital expenditures. The technology part of it seems a little strained. I might be wrong, but I don't think that New York is that far behind on the technology. I think the state has put a lot of money into technology and infrastructure. But do you think that this is designed to preempt the environmentalists?
I don't know. I think that I see it more in the cast against de Blasio. You know, of course, Bill de Blasio, as we've said, wants this income tax like that Cuomo is certainly less than thrilled about. I'm waiting to see a lot of the numbers in both the state budget and on this bond act. I think we're going to see a decent portion of the revenue that it raises going to pre-K related construction. Because as you point out, Frank, a lot of the technology stuff has happened. He wants to make every school building in the state wireless. Well, what percentage of them are wireless? This is not cutting edge technology anymore. It's five, you know, we're about 5 years past when that would have been more cutting edge or innovative. You guys are on the RPI campus where I think you could get 17 Wi-Fi signals no matter where you were. So I want more details on that one. And I don't know if it's designed to preempt the environmental bond idea. I don't know if they'll be rolled together. We're just going to have to wait.
Yeah, I don't think that would be possible. Maybe it would be, but one of the problems a number of reformers have suggested amending the Constitution to change this, but currently the way it works in New York is you're only allowed to have one bond issue on the ballot at a time.
Mm.
You can't have more than one. A number of reformers, including people who are not ideologically conservative or liberal but pay a lot of attention to the Constitution, have been talking for years about a constitutional amendment that would allow more than one bond issue at a time. Because one of the problems with the current law is there's also a constraint on too much confused mixing in the packages. So there's supposed to be some coherence to a bond act, but we're in the weeds now, so we'll turn it over to Ron for a final, more political question.
Now, actually, I was going to ask more of a personal question, Jimmy, and you had mentioned to me you kind of have a special place in your heart for this radio station here at WRPI. Uh-huh. Maybe you could tell us why. I thought it was a great story.
Well, this is semi-apocryphal here, but my father, as I said, was an RPI grad, class 76 and 77, I think. He loved it so much he stayed an extra year to get a master's. And he really, in the way that I kind of sold my soul to the college newspaper, sold his soul to WRPI. He loved it. He really loved the music it exposed him to. And my mother was a Troy resident and had moved back from college. And they actually met kind of over the radio. She would call into a radio show that a friend of mine had, I believe. And I'm a little hazy on the exact details, but I always understood that they sort of met through WRPI. And let me do some quick math here. 34 years later, and despite two hellion little boys, myself being one of them, they're still going strong. So always a pleasure to be on WRPI, and thanks so much for having me.
We're matchmakers here at WRPI.
We do it all.
This is the People's Business on WRPI Troy, and we've been pleased to be able to speak with Jimmy Vealtine, Capital Bureau Chief for Capital New York. That's Capital with an A, New York, all spelled out, .com. Jimmy, thank you very much for taking the time to speak with us this morning.
Thanks, Frank.
Thank
thanks,
you, Jimmy.
Ron. Thanks,
Take
Brian.
Care.
Bye.
This is the People's Business on WRPI Troy. And we're later in today's program going to be speaking with State Senator Diane Savino. But before we do that, we'll just provide a little context for the rhythm that the state government is in currently. As we said at the beginning and talked about with Jimmy, the governor gave his State of the State message yesterday on the opening day of the legislative session, kicks off the session, lays out his priorities for the years, follows up with his budget in 2 weeks on January 21st, and with both program bills, which are our governor's program bills, are the big bills that deliver on the big promises in the State of the State message, and departmental bills, which deal with more technical matters. In terms of what's going to happen this year, in terms of what's been laid out so far, Brian, what do you think is going to be the big controversies between the governor and various interest groups in and around the Capitol?
Well, I think you're going to see a push and pull between various ideologies, right? So in our state, the mayor of New York, by virtue of the size of that city and the huge magnifying glass that city is under, the mayor gets a lot of attention. And we now have a new mayor of New York City who was elected with 75% of the vote. And many of us who observe politics are used to Democrats taking strong positions in elections and then immediately retreating once they start to govern. And we have not seen Bill de Blasio do that. So if anything, he's been more aggressive with his populist agenda. Again, if you're reading the tea leaves, this is a guy who has said he wants to have the right to raise taxes a little bit more on the wealthiest New Yorkers, New York City residents, so that he can fund universal pre-K. When the governor, there's a little bit of sparring back and forth in the media between the governor and the mayor. When the governor sort of sent up a trial balloon that maybe he would add some more funding for these programs, de Blasio basically said, well, if you want to send us more money, we'll take it. We'll be happy to take it.
Plenty of places we can spend it.
But right. We'd still like to have the authority to tax our own citizens to pay for the programs that are desperately needed.
Yes. I would say, too, I'm just fascinated by the dynamic that's being set up right now. You have a governor who's, self-proclaimed progressive, but completely out of step with, leading Democrats in this country, like President Obama, like Vice President Biden, President or the Pope even is talking about income inequality.
Didn't expect that to happen.
And far more progressive than our governor. And it seems, the tax policies that the governor has laid out, the biggest support is coming from the Senate Republicans who, want to, put themselves right up there with the governor and say, yeah, we need to cut taxes. But it seems that the tax cut package that the governor put together is, disproportionately favors the wealthy in some instances, in particular outside of the property tax circuit breaker that he proposed or the renter credit, which we all support. The governor is really talking about things like, reducing the estate tax for the very wealthiest in New York State. And we're talking about hundreds of millions of dollars going to literally the richest 200 estates in this state. So
that would probably be the part of the proposal that Pope Francis would have the biggest problem with. What are the differences you're getting at is maybe explained by the fact that Pope Francis is from Argentina and Andrew Cuomo is from Holliswood in Queens. It's not quite Staten Island, but it's not Argentina.
So another factor we may want to look at is what's going to happen with Shelley Silver? Because if you look at what recent media reports about the speaker. The speaker seems very much on board with the de Blasio agenda. The speaker has been saying that he thinks that the city of New York ought to have the right to tax its own residents, right? We do these bills all the time through the legislature to allow municipalities to raise their tax rates. And New York City and Yonkers are two places that have, their own income tax system. So Shelley's going to be a very interesting player in this whole conversation. And I think because we pay so much attention to the dynamics within the state Senate over the last few years, we've maybe not paid as much attention to the speaker. And the speaker is a wily operator. We should never underestimate Shelley Silver. And he has a Democratic majority, many of whose members have been a little frustrated by the path that this state's been going down for the last several years. So it's going to be very interesting to see how that plays out.
Speaker Silver I also a day or two ago staked out a very interesting position on the property tax relief. One of the things the governor has done is, in response to initial criticism from New York City media and from the Black, Puerto Rican, Hispanic, and Asian caucus, he originally did not include renters in his proposed circuit breaker proposal, but he added a renter's credit. And interestingly enough, the speaker the other day said that having a renter's credit isn't a sufficient reason for excluding New York City residents from the circuit breaker.
Right.
Now, I don't think they are excluded from the circuit breaker, but they are excluded from the property tax freeze. Rather than including them in the property tax freeze, I think it's going to be important to explain the mechanical nightmare the property tax freeze would represent, and not do the property tax freeze and do a circuit breaker that clearly includes New York City. But I think the speaker, even though I might see the details a little more, I think the speaker has staked out a very interesting position on the property tax relief. This is the People's Business on WRPI Troy, 91.5 FM over the air in northeastern New York, western Massachusetts, and southern Vermont, and worldwide via the internet at WRPI.org. And we are now pleased to be joined on the telephone by Senator Dianne Savino. Senator Savino, thank you very much for joining us this morning.
You're welcome. Good morning.
Good morning.
This is Brian McDonald, and I'd like to welcome our guest, Senator Savino. Happy New Year, Dianne.
Happy New Year, Brian.
Senator Savino represents the North Shore of Staten Island and parts of Brooklyn. She was first elected to the state Senate in 2004 and has been reelected to the Senate four times since then. Before that, Senator Savino was a social worker, a longtime social worker in New York City, and a union activist. And now Senator Savino is one of the four members of the Independent Democratic Caucus in the state Senate. So, Senator, we've been talking about yesterday's State of the State address and all the happenings at the state capitol. What do you think? What do you predict for the coming year? I mean, it's an election year. Obviously, there's going to be a lot going on. What do you think? And what do you think about yesterday's remarks by the governor?
Well, I think overall, yesterday was a reflection of where we were and where we're going. You know, when you think back 4 years ago, we were looking at a $10 billion budget deficit after having had a $6 billion budget deficit the year before and the collapse of the economy in 2008. So for the first time, I guess on the plus side, for the first time, we're not talking about massive budget cuts. We're not talking about reduction in services. You know, we're not talking about targeting anybody for pain. We're on the plus side of the ledger. We have a surplus. And sometimes that presents just as many challenges as when you have a deficit, because, all budgets are political documents, are about your priorities. So the governor put out his priorities yesterday, which is continuing in his belief that, we have to provide tax relief across the board, and we have to reduce the cost of doing business in New York so we can attract more private sector business. And again, this is, his belief. Sometimes he's right on these things. It's not all bad. All businesses are not all bad. And I think, unfortunately, people kind of like draw lines in the sand sometimes that really are more ideological than practical. But he laid out his agenda. The legislature will respond. That we'll lay out our agenda. As some of you have been watching in the past few weeks, the IDC, the Independent Democratic Conference, we put out our legislative agenda for the year, Affordable New York. And so some of those are in conflict. I shouldn't say conflict. Some of those are not referenced in the governor's priorities. It's our job now to push, since there's money on the table. We think some of that money can be spent in a better way than just giving business tax cuts. So it's round one, and I think it's going to be an interesting year. It wasn't – what was missing, though, yesterday, I think, is, the lofty rhetoric that Governor Cuomo can sometimes be I don't want to say accused of using, but so he does it very well, but it wasn't there, so I'm not sure what that meant.
Explain that a little more. You think that
he's a wonderful orator,
right?
And he usually in his speeches he'll build up to some climax, and there'll be a point to it. That passionate delivery didn't seem to exist yesterday, and perhaps it's because he feels we're on the right path. I don't know. It's hard to tell.
Well, yeah, it might be good, because even though he was passionate last year, I think there was a lot of proper criticism that the crescendo he raised up to, he reached on the women's equality agenda and on the SAFE Act seemed like screeching to a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, it's interesting you mention the women's thing. He said something very pointed yesterday, and I hope people were listening. He said it's time to take the politics out of the women's equality agenda. The fact is there is massive unanimous support in both houses for the vast majority of the women's equality agenda. In fact, the 9 points out of the 10. The stumbling block is expanding what some people describe as expanding abortion rights in New York State. Other people describe merely as codifying Roe v. Wade into New York State law. That's the stumbling block. It shouldn't be used as a political weapon to prevent us from finally adopting strong laws against human trafficking, or in or finally passing pay equity for women in New York State, or finally, you know, improving circumstances for victims of domestic violence, or pregnancy discrimination, or housing discrimination. You know, so we shouldn't allow the politics of that, you know, national fight over abortion rights to overshadow the other issues that will really make a profound change for many women in New York State. Now, that being said, I think it's fair to remind people that abortion rights in New York State are not under threat. You can have an abortion anywhere in New York State. Women have the right to protect their own reproductive health, and that should continue, and it will continue because we are not Kentucky or Alabama or anywhere else. But women in New York State still need those other protections in the women's equality. So let's take the politics out and let's do the right thing for women in New York State.
Right. I agree. I think the other piece is that, and you talked about it, you know, it was kind of a non-climactic speech yesterday. I don't know how you feel about the comedy routine that always he seems to insert in this, whether that's becoming of a governor or not, but it seemed like he was like warming up for his stint at the new Catskill Casino or something. But let's turn our attention to something else you talked about. You know, we have this magical $2 billion surplus that's coming down the pike as a result, really.
But it's three years from now.
Three years from now. Right? Well, coming down the pike. Right.
I'm sorry to interrupt your question, but I'll come back to you in a minute. But what strikes me is, given that the governor has talked about the $2 billion, I've heard so many legislators in media interviews saying, now that we have a $2 billion surplus.
Right.
And the governor was very clear in his chart yesterday that we only have a $2 billion surplus 3 years from now if we hold spending to 2% a year for 3 years between now and then.
So it's a projected surplus. Right. So we're continuing our austerity measures. And you kind of spoke about this yesterday, and I've heard you talk about this fact that, look, if we have a $2 billion surplus, it's because of the fact that, you know, we've been engaging in these austerity budgets, cutting lots of services. I mean, human services alone have received about $1 billion in cuts over the last 3 years. So there's a lot of lost ground to make up here. And, you know, we have a state where we have the greatest income inequality, child poverty, record hunger, record homelessness. It didn't seem that the governor was addressing any of those issues, which I think are very important to a lot of New Yorkers. Even in upstate, you know, we have our major upstate cities with 50% child poverty rates, which is just astounding in a state with, you know, so much wealth and so many resources. He didn't seem to address that at all, which was disturbing to me. I don't know how you felt about that.
Well, you know, I'm going to go out on a limb and assume that a lot of those issues will be addressed or not addressed in the budget. You know, the state of the state, I think we've come to expect that the state of the state is going to be a lot more detailed than not. And the truth is, it's not supposed to be. It's supposed to be like a broad overview of where, you know, the governor wants to go. And then we all start to pick it apart and say, I think I know where he's going with that. We will find out relatively soon what he intends to do with that $2 billion surplus. I've spoken to him about some of the severe cuts that have been imposed over the past few years. And, you know, that while we have this money, there's going to be a call for us to make restorations. He said that a lot of that will be addressed in the budget, that, you know, it's not all about just giving the money away. It's about right-sizing, you know, some of the cuts that we had to Washington Post. He talked a lot yesterday about education. He's talking about restorations to education and improvements to education. He's talking about a bond act for the creation of technology for schools to bring our schools into the 21st century. So I think what we should do is wait and see what the budget says before we pass judgment on whether or not we're making restorations. But again, at that point, that's the legislature's fight.
Yeah.
That's where we put forward our priorities. I know for the IDC, part of our Affordable New York is talking about child care restoration. You know, we need to restore the child care block grant cuts that were imposed over the past few years. That is essential. You know, if our economy is going to work, we have to have stable child care for working families. And the cost of child care in New York State for those who aren't eligible for subsidized care, and there are not enough of them, the cost of child care can range anywhere from $300 a week to, you know, to several thousand if you have more than one child. Many of our families, they just drop out of the workforce. Women drop out of the workforce because they can't afford to provide child care to their children. We need to turn that around. So, you know, we're going to be fighting for things like that. I'm sure you'll hear from other members of the legislature that they want to make restorations to previous cuts. I'm going to assume that the developmental disabilities community is going to say, hey, we need some of that money back too. So we'll be, you know, it's a good thing, though, when you're battling over money that's there and not money that's not there.
Senator, I'm going to take issue with one of the things you said. You said he's a wonderful orator. I'm not so sure about that. I got to tell you, I'm not sure I like this presentation by PowerPoint. This PowerPoint presentation for a state of the state, I'm not sure I'm crazy about it. There also seems to be a laundry list of programs that the governor likes to, and now we're going to talk about this. It's like he's checking off these boxes. But one of the things I want to bring up is taxation, right? Mm-hmm. So last week, the governor had a press conference, and it was titled Cutting Taxes. And during his state of the state presentation yesterday, he talked about manufacturing upstate and how there will be no business taxes. So my question is, he's got this long laundry list of programs that he wants to put into place. But at the same time, he believes in cutting taxes. So who's going to deliver the services if we have no tax base, if we have no revenue? If we want to bond to increase technology in schools and we have about 20,000 less teachers in the schools now, which was one of the unanticipated consequences of having this tax cap, who's going to deliver these services? Is it going to be automated computers in the school system, like when you check out a Home Depot now? There's no one there to actually check you out. So I'm not sure exactly who's going to deliver all these essential services because we have so fewer people delivering these.
It's a very good question, Brian. And I am sure as we begin the budget hearings, those are going to be some of the things that the legislature is going to want to know. I've been saying this for several years now. Our state workforce, in particular, not counties and municipalities, just the state workforce, is at the lowest level it's been in more than 25 years. And I remind people all the time, just because the workers go away doesn't mean the work does. The public still demands the same level of service. And we're seeing the effect in some of the state agencies in the length of time it takes to get a liquor license, if you're a small business and you're applying for one, in how long it takes the Department of Labor, DOL in particular, to respond to allegations of wage theft or misclassification or, you know, enforcement of labor law. That's a disservice to the people. You know, we have some of the strongest labor laws in the nation, but they're not worth the paper they're printed on if no one enforces them. So we're going to be asking those questions. You know, where are we? And when are we going to begin, you know, the process of hiring again? When are we going to plan for the future of the state agencies? We can't contract out everything.
Well, and another piece of this, right, is that the governor talked about how many layers. What he said was we have high property taxes because we have so much local government. Now, he didn't mention that the state has cut back dramatically on the state aid to localities. But he said we should have, you know, forced consolidation, basically. And then he highlighted, he said, you know, how many, since I've been attorney general, how many local governments have actually consolidated? Two. Now, what he didn't mention is that dozens of local governments have taken votes and democratically gone before their voters, and they've all been voted down because people like their local government.
Yes, but people don't like the cost of their local government. This is a perpetual problem for those of us in Albany. And I'll use the property tax cap as an example. I come from the city of New York, so the property tax cap doesn't apply to us, doesn't affect us. We don't vote on our budgets, as you know. But we, for you know, years, county officials, town officials, village officials would come to Albany and say, if Albany would just cap our property taxes, we could reduce the cost, as if they didn't have the ability to cap them themselves. They didn't have to propose increases. They just wanted someone else to blame for it. So The response from the Albany legislators was, okay, we'll cap your property taxes. They didn't want that. What they really want is more money. Okay, very simple. So everybody wants to spend money. Nobody wants to raise the money themselves, and they want, you know. So yesterday, in the middle of the governor's speech, you know, I think what he's talking about now is when we did the consolidation legislation that encouraged local governments to consolidate services, and he pointed out only two of them did, that's the carrot. So sometimes you use the carrot, and sometimes you use the stick. Now he's going to look to use the stick. I don't know whether that will be any more successful than the carrot was, but there is no doubt that there are too many layers of local government, sewer districts, fire districts, all, and many of these districts spent an incredible amount of money for a relatively small amount of service. So I think if we can push towards that, because that's also money that can be better spent on services to the community. You know, you have sometimes a fire district supervisor. They earn $150,000. That's absurd.
Now, you know, Senator, New York is one of the few states in the country that passes on Medicaid costs to local government.
Yes.
So that is, local governments are screaming that they have these massive costs for Medicaid, mm-hmm. that it's a state mandate passed down to them. And they say, you know, if we didn't have so many of these state mandates, then local government would be a whole lot less expensive.
Right. They say 85% of their budgets are mandated by the state.
Right. And we're moving towards, you know, taking over the Medicaid costs of the counties. And that's a massive expense. But again, it's all out of the same pot, you know? I mean, there's only so much money to go around. But we acknowledge that there are state mandates that we pass on and that we should find a way to provide the funding for or to pick up the cost entirely. And at the same time, there's got to be some acknowledgement at the local level that they need to consolidate where they can. Not everything. You don't have to eliminate. I understand the concept of, you know, local the local democracy. I understand the identity issue. You know, some people say, well, we'll lose our identity if we merge with another. I get that. We understand that. Everybody wants, you know, to be able to control their own destinies. But they have to find a way to control the cost, too, because to the extent that we have to give more money to localities, that's less money for state services. There's only so much money in the pot.
This is The People's Business on WRPI Troy, and we're speaking with State Senator Diane Savino, who represents the North Shore of Staten Island and nearby parts
of
Brooklyn, I think including Coney Island.
Yes, and Brighton Beach and a little piece of Sheepshead Bay and a little piece of Bay Ridge and Bensonhurst.
You're coming up on a decade in the state legislature?
Mm-hmm. Yes, amazing.
Based on that experience, given that there's a lot of criticism of the way the New York legislature works that I personally think is unfounded, but I might be wrong. What's your conclusion after almost 10 years of what it takes for an individual legislator in a system like the New York legislature to be effective?
I think in order to be effective, you have to be willing to you have to be willing to negotiate with people. And I think, unfortunately, in politics these days, people, they retreat to their side of the aisle, and they're unwilling to talk to each other. You see what's happening in Washington. You know, they're very good at coming out every morning with their talking points and appearing on whatever the, you know, local television show is. But none of them are willing to talk to each other. And I don't know, I think, Brian, maybe I learned this in the labor movement. That was the best training I ever had for the legislature. If you approach your opponent as if they are evil, or as if their position is completely non-negotiable, you're never going to get anywhere. You have to be willing to, first of all, if you want to be a successful legislator, you need to build consensus for your issues among other members of the legislature. You cannot introduce a bill and then expect someone else to deliver it. Way too many of my colleagues do that. They think it's someone else's responsibility. No, you have to work your legislation. A perfect example is I've been working on medical marijuana. I'm going to continue to do that this year. The governor's proposed a change in regulation. I support his move. I don't think what he's proposing is workable, which means I have to continue to build support among the members of the Senate to pass a bill. And what that means is sitting down and talking, taking into consideration their input, trying to determine whether or not their opposition is, can you overcome it? That's how you build, that's how you're successful as a legislator.
We have high hopes for the passage of medical marijuana.
Yes. And by the way,
no,
we could produce a lot of revenue.
That's true. We like the revenue.
Yes.
I had a question for you. So it's, you made the point of saying that the governor's state of the state kind of is a broad brush, almost outline, and, you know, not all the specifics are there. But very clearly on Monday, he laid out a specific tax-cutting agenda for this surplus, you know, this surplus that's down the road 3 years or so, how to spend that $2 billion. And he was very clear about how he wanted to do that with hundreds of millions of dollars in estate tax cuts, a property tax freeze, eliminating the bank tax, a lot of things that, you know, a lot of progressives aren't very thrilled about, to say the least. I mean, I think we like the notion of targeted tax relief to people who need it the most via a circuit breaker, certainly something that the IDC has supported in the past.
Mm-hmm.
I think you probably like the idea of a renter credit, but how do we reconcile, you know, these tax breaks for millionaires over tax breaks for the middle class? And where does the IDC land on this? It seems like you're pushing a much more kind of progressive agenda. And how are you going to be able to reconcile that with your partners in the Senate Republicans?
Well, you're right. We have been advocating this. We've said this very clearly. For the past couple of years, we have given away a lot of business tax credits. In fact, in last year's budget, we did a lot for businesses. We did the first small business tax credit for small businesses that earn less than $250,000 a year. We did a tax credit program for businesses that hire veterans. We did a lot. And in fact, I mean, you mentioned that I came into the legislature in 2004. It's almost 10 years. Since 2005, when I was first elected, the state of New York gave away about $335 million in tax incentives through a variety of programs that never worked, by the way, to businesses to encourage them to create jobs with no real accountability. Mm-hmm. As of now, we probably give close to $4 billion a year in those same kind of programs. We've expanded it, you know, 10 times in the 10 years, and yet and still, it's done nothing to create the economic development that it was supposed to. We need to look at those programs. Before we throw more money at the business community without any accountability, we need to examine the existing programs that don't seem to work. We need to take some of that money back, and we need to find a better way to spend it. So that's on the economic development side. On the other side, you're right. We need to provide tax relief in the form of better programs like paid family leave, like affordable child care, like expanding and developing real affordable housing programs for people. That's how we can provide, you know, tax relief for working people and low-wage working people. Let's take some of the money that's spent and put it to better use. And if we don't do that, if we don't make New York affordable for working people, we have no future as the Empire State.
Senator, I'm going to pivot to politics for a second.
Sure.
So you're a member of the IDC. There are four members now. There were five last year. We're going into an election year in 2014. I'm going to ask you, what's the future of the IDC? But before I let you answer, I'm going to say a few more things. So Senator Fuscillo from Long Island, a Republican, has decided not to run for re-election. Senator Lee Zeldin from Long Island, a Republican, is choosing instead to run for Congress, is not going to run for re-election. Senator Eric Adams, a Democrat from Brooklyn, is moved on to higher or different office. We don't know what's going to happen with Senator Malcolm Smith. So there are going to be a lot of changes in the state Senate. So what's the future of the IDC going into the 2014 elections?
Well, we're obviously going to, you know, run for re-election ourselves. We think we've been very successful in pushing, you know, issues that we care about. You know, we're going to continue to do that through this legislative session. And listen, there'll be elections in November. I don't know what the future of the Senate looks like. You know, everyone now is starting to, you know, say, well, the Democrats will pick up five seats. Maybe they will. I don't know. Or the Republicans will win back the seats that they lost. Maybe they will. I think it's important that first we focus on the people's business. The session will end in June. The political season will start then. And then we'll take a look at the lay of the land. I can't predict what's going to happen in November, and I certainly can't tell you what's going to happen next January. What I can tell you is between now and then, the four of us are going to continue to work on the things that we know are necessary. If we make this purely political, right, from today going forward, we won't accomplish anything. Because people will retreat to their side of the aisle or whatever, and they won't want to accomplish anything. We have a very aggressive agenda for people, for the people of the state of New York. The governor has one. The assembly is going to have one. And we cannot afford to allow the political landscape to interfere with the, you know, governmental one right now. But, you know, politics will come soon enough, as they always do.
So this progressive agenda, I mean, you guys outlined working on affordable housing. You're talking mm-hmm. about circuit breakers, renter mm-hmm. credits.
I just want to make the point. We passed a circuit breaker twice.
I know.
In the Senate, when we had a Democratic majority. The Assembly would never do it. So no, I'll be very surprised to see.
That's not completely true. The Assembly in the August 2008 special session passed a circuit breaker. We didn't think we... being the Fiscal Policy Institute, where I used to mm-hmm. be the executive director in New Yorkers Fiscal Fairness, where Ron is, we were critical of it, but they did pass a circuit breaker. What from our perspective was wrong with it is it had too low a threshold, mm-hmm. which meant that it brought in too many people, and because it brought in so many people, it couldn't give much relief to anyone, and so it really was another way of recreating the star rebate mm-hmm. checks, water but down. Making mm-hmm. it sound like a circuit breaker. To my shock, the governor included two pages in the 200-page written version of his book yesterday. He actually has a lower threshold than the Assembly had in 2008 in the bill they passed, and a smaller credit percentage. So the way the bill, his bill works is the thresholds are 2, 3, and 4%. Your property taxes mm-hmm. have to be over that percentage of your income. That's more than half the homeowners mm-hmm. of the state.
Right.
A circuit breaker is supposed to target relief to people who are overburdened. So because it brings in so many people, the credit percentages, the percentage of the overage of your property taxes over that percentage of your income is incredibly small, 20, 15, or 10%. The Assembly bill had been a little higher, but still not acceptable, 25, 20, and 10%. The Galef-Little bill by Betty Little and Sandra Galef, which is the original big middle-class circuit breaker credit, is 70% credit. So I'm sorry I got off on this tangent, but I was just reacting to your point that the Assembly never passed a circuit breaker. They passed a circuit breaker, but it wasn't great. But the governor's is worse.
And if I recall, the belief was that they knew it wouldn't be acceptable, and that's why it was okay for them to pass it. You know, the point you're making though is this is a very complicated issue. How do you provide tax relief to the people who need it the most without either spreading it across too many people or not enough people? Right. It's very complicated.
So
you know, and I remember a few years ago, before Senator Saland, left the Senate, he did a blue ribbon panel. He had a blue ribbon commission to study how to lower property taxes in the suburban and rural communities. And the response that came back from the blue ribbon panel was very simple. You need a county income tax, but it was roundly rejected, and as a result of it, the Blue Ribbon Commission was, you know, put in a drawer somewhere to gather dust. Unfortunately, you know, the reason why New York City property taxes are so low, besides the fact that we have a lot more people and we have a commercial real estate taxes,
and you have an income tax,
and we have an income tax, and we don't vote on our budgets, we don't vote on our school budgets, our education funding comes from the state and the city. So you don't have the school taxes driving local taxes. Property taxes are an incredibly regressive way of paying for government services.
We're going to have to wrap up, but we greatly appreciate the time you took this morning to join with us.
You're
welcome. Business on WRPI Troy, and we have been speaking with State Senator Diane Savino, who represents part of Staten Island and parts of Brooklyn in the State Senate. Senator Savino, thank you very much for taking the time to speak with us this morning.
You're welcome. Talk to you soon, guys.
Thank you, Senator.
This is The People's Business on WRPI Troy, a production of the Fiscal Policy Institute and WRPI's Public Affairs Committee, and a part of WRPI's regular Thursday morning feature, Capital District Progressive Radio. I'm Frank Morrow, Executive Director Emeritus of the Fiscal Policy Institute, and I'm joined here in the WRPI studio by Brian McDonald, AFSCME New York's Legislative and Political Director, and Ron Deutsch, Executive Director of New Yorkers Fiscal Fairness. Please join us again on Thursday, February 6th, and now stay tuned for Democracy Now!